Macro and Asset Allocation Funds conference call and our outlook for 2014. I'm David Rothberg, and with me somewhere is Al Friedberg. Hi, Al. How you doing?
Good. I'm in the cloud.
In the cloud. Okay. And with good reason, which we'll get to in a moment. Just to recount the drill, first I have to announce the date because Eddie Roth tells me that I must do that. And so today is February the 4th, 2014. And to let investors know, the way it works is we usually talk for about 40 minutes, and I respond mostly to questions. I act as a bit of an interlocutor to Albert. I sit on the risk management committee of the fund, and I also field questions from investors. I have a host of them in front of me that I'm going to ask him. If you have any questions during the call, you can send them to me at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca, and I'll do my best to put them to Albert. I'm going to take it upon myself to put the first comment to you, Al, and I'm going to put it to you not as a member of the risk management committee, but as a fairly substantial investor in the fund myself, by saying that while I have not entirely forgiven you for losing all that money last year, I am extremely grateful for the fantastic performance during January. What was it, a 15, 16, 17%?
I guess so.
So thank you very, very much for that. The thing that I notice, and now I'm going back to being on the risk management committee, the thing that I notice is that the returns in January came from all sources. In other words, it was not that you generated all that 17% from any single bet on housing. It wasn't for your bearish position on Europe. They came from everywhere. In fact, those returns were almost the mirror image of the losses that you took in the dark days of 2013. Can you talk about that and explain how this horror and then this redemption has taken place?
Okay, I just want to make sure that you hear me well.
I hear you very
well. You hear
well,
me well? Eddie, you hear me well? Okay.
Perfectly, thank you.
Fine. Right, so really the performance this January is a bit of a mirror image of what happened last summer, where, in my opinion, the markets were acting in a very irrational manner by driving up, primarily at the time, they were driving up emerging markets in the face of fears of higher rates, higher interest rates, but at the same time were not doing anything. In fact, were actually punishing us in the housing sector and driving down housing stocks. So the market was taking sort of a bifurcated view that high interest rates would not affect the emerging markets and would affect our housing market. So that was sort of the main feature of that August debacle. It didn't make a lot of sense, but, you know, you just don't argue with markets. That's what happens. I think that we are now in a much more rational type of an environment. Markets are now concerned, truly concerned, that the withdrawal of liquidity from the emerging, and we'll talk more about it later, but that the withdrawal of liquidity from the emerging markets is going to cause some harm to them. At the same time, the level of rates, of interest rates, mortgage rates, long-term rates have stabilized quite a bit and off their highest point in the last few months. And we are seeing very good activity in the home builder sector. So I believe things have normalized. At the same time, we still have this which in the summer we didn't have it, but now we have a bit of fear again coming into the market, and that's doing good. That's doing wonders for our bonds position, long bonds position. So that's something that we didn't have with us in the summer. And the gold market is starting to act better also because of some deep fear in the recesses of the minds of some of the players, plus what appears to be a very large movement of gold, physical gold, to the east, absorbing almost all our supplies in the west. And so actually, it's a bit of a mirror image. I think that things are happening the way we expected them to happen, and I expect them to continue to happen, to move in that direction, which maybe we'll have a chance to talk about a little more in the rest of the conversation.
Okay. So let's then just summarize where we're at. Basically, we're long gold roughly to the tune of about 40% of the NAV.
A little bit more if you take some options into account. I'd say that with options, you're probably closer to 50, maybe 45%.
We're long bunds to the tune of, is it 60% of the NAV?
No, bunds is 100% of the NAV.
100% of the NAV.
Mm-hmm.
60% of the NAV is a long position in home builders.
Mm-hmm.
And 60, that is counterbalanced by a short position in India, Brazil, two individual securities in China, and
emerging market ETFs, and an emerging market play,
and also some short positions in the standard in the S&P futures index.
Right.
And then we still have a very secular bearish stance on oil.
Correct.
So let's talk about those individually. But before we do, the economic background or the economic backdrop to this portfolio, is this a deflationary environment? Is this an environment that has ghosts hidden behind the curtains or in the closets? What does the world look like to you now? Because even though the portfolio is the same as it was last summer, still the world changes.
Right. Well, it's the same, but it's a little less leveraged. Okay, so that will qualify that. It is the same, but it's got about 40% less positions in total, meaning gross 40% less. So that means a little less on the long side, a little less on the short side. But generally, that is the same. And the question is, what's the theme? What is the main theme behind these positions?
Exactly.
And I have to say that it is a bit mixed, but it tends towards global weakness, global stagflation, maybe even worse, global stagnation with some deflation in raw material prices. And that has to do with the slowing of activity in places like China, and emerging markets that have constituted the most of the demand for raw materials. So that would put a deflationary tinge on commodity prices. Generally, these economies are all slowing down. The big ones like India and like Brazil and like China, they're all slowing down. So we are betting on that. And we are saying that the debt problem, the serious debt problem that took place, that has taken place, that has enveloped the whole world, has not gotten any better, has actually gotten worse. And the debt servicing capacity of most nations in the world today has been diminished tremendously, and more so than ever, so that hovers over the market. And that's the kind of thing that has a very strong deflationary power to it. So if you ask me what the portfolio leans towards, yes, it leans towards stagnation in global growth, towards deflation in raw materials at least, and it actually also leans towards a better environment in the U.S., saying that the U.S. economy is continuing to improve. It is now benefiting from this tremendous energy resurgence or renaissance. It is, I guess, benefiting from very low interest rates. We still have the next stage to come, which is CapEx. There's been very little capital expenditure, so we should have now another leg up in the economic cycle with the demand for capital expenditure equipment. Home builders have experienced now very good demand and continue to experience good demand. Good pricing, good demand. There's a shortage of good homes. So our view is, I would say then, constructive, very constructive for the U.S. economy for now. That is not to say that if we get into a market spill, that it will not affect the U.S. It may. But we still have some pretty good fundamentals here, a narrowing of the fiscal deficit, a sharp narrowing of the fiscal deficit. So our bet is that the U.S. will do much, much better differentially than the rest of the world.
Okay. Let's look at some of the individual positions, and let's start with gold. You're leaning towards a deflationary environment. Most listeners, I think, will associate gold with a hedge against inflation. At the same time, there's some funny business going on now in the COMEX, where the COMEX, which used to be used solely as a pricing mechanism, is being system. A great deal of gold is moving from the east or from the west to the east. Is this part of the reason why you're long gold? Can you flesh that out a little bit for us, please?
Yeah, yeah. What's happening, I think, is that the world is beginning to feel. And when I say the world, I mean a lot of informed consumers and a lot of informed investors who are concerned about keeping their money anywhere in financial institutions. Are now demanding gold, and you can see that simply by looking at what's happening in coin demand. The main mints around the world are working now full-time, 24/7. They don't have enough capacity to supply the demand for gold coins. So there's a tremendous amount of demand, and this is in Australia and in Austria and in the United States and in Canada, everywhere. So there is tremendous demand for gold coin. You would think that after a bear market that we had, where the market dropped significantly, more than a third, you'd think that the sentiment would be bearish, but it's not. The sentiment may be bearish among hedge funds, and the sentiment may be bearish among newspaper reporters, but it is not bearish among the people, and that's a very strong support to the market. In addition to that, we know that there is physical gold moving continuously to the east from Swiss refiners and moving to China, and maybe people in China are sensing a financial crisis, and so they're buying gold, or maybe it is the Chinese government itself buying gold. There's rumors that they have three times more gold in international reserves that they're declaring. So whatever it is, the demand for gold seems to be pretty strong now. It is not so much an inflation hedge, although that's the way people talk about it. It's more like an insecurity hedge.
Yep.
It's the ultimate hedge. The
yep.
hedge is like the one thing that I want to have under my mattress practically, but I want to make sure that I have something. And so I think that that's happening, and it will result in substantially higher prices at some point.
Do you think that, and I'm really being speculative here, do you think that the anxiety that people feel and that they make manifest by buying gold is localized in the sense that people fear in particular a debt crisis in Europe or an inflation in India? Or do you think that there is a kind of systemic, a generalized feeling of systemic crisis lurking?
That's what it is. It's the latter. This uneasiness, an uneasiness. You know, it's funny. It's coupled, this uneasiness is also coupled by extreme bullishness on the part of people who invest in Wall Street products. And so you do have a lot of bullishness about people who are very plain thinking about the situation and who think that everything is fine and interest rates are low and there's a great rotation going from bonds now to stocks and everything will follow the previous cycles and the previous patterns. So there's a large sector of the population thinking that way. But there is also a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear and an uneasiness that even some of these people have. And I believe that that's what's being reflected.
Well, the last time that you, that if you were to if I were to have asked you 3 months ago where you thought the pinpoint of anxiety might reside, I think you would have said Europe. But today, I believe you'd say emerging markets. Would that be right?
No. I would say that emerging markets are going through a more or less typical crisis, which is they have boomed, they have grown very quickly, especially credit has grown very quickly, and now they have to retrench. And that's a classic case. That's what's happening, for instance, in India or in China. Credit has gotten out of hand, the boom has gotten out of hand, and so there is some problems. In India, for example, you have a current account problem, you have an inflation problem. Those are indicators of problems, so they have to take those into account and they have to do something about it. Same thing as Brazil. That's more typical, more classic. Underlying all this, and standing in the forefront practically, but standing in the foreground, I would say, is the debt problem. And the European debt problem is number one. Number one because these countries cannot grow, have not been able to grow faster than what debt is accruing, cannot possibly overcome the increase in debt. And so that problem is getting larger and larger, and it's forcing governments, their governments, to adopt what in their minds is an austerity program. But to the extent that they're being not implemented properly, they are austerity programs, and they are people, and they are making people poorer, and they are retarding economic growth. So we still have this problem in Greece where debt has gone way out of line with what was expected to be. After the default, it was thought that debt to GDP would hover around 120%, and would begin to decline afterwards. It's well over 175 now. Debt to GDP in Greece is over
100%. In Greece, I'm sorry.
Yeah. In Italy, it's like 145 when it was thought to come down to under 100. I don't remember off the top of my head the numbers in Portugal and Spain, but they are just off the charts. And they're clearly way off what they were, what they expected when this whole process began, this retrenchment process began. So that stands there, and that grows, and that's a monster, and that will explode. And so I can't say that I've shifted my attention. I've had my attention on the emerging market, and that's why the emerging market is a little different. It is more a typical, a traditional, a classic economic cycle, and that's what we're playing those. And we only chosen those countries where we think have problems like that. As I say, India, Brazil, Turkey, China. But that's more typical. I have more to say about this problem, what I call more typical. But I'll find another opportunity later.
Okay. Well, let me try and bounce back between emerging markets and European markets. I think 20 years ago, if you were to think of cycles, you would apply the term cycles to developed markets, and you would think of blow-ups, accidents, traumas in emerging markets. Are you saying that if there were a trauma, it would be in now Europe, developed markets, and in fact, this is just a cyclical event, so that what's happening in the emerging world is not something that people have to, we're not going to see a repeat in Brazil of what we saw during the 70s, and we're not going to see, but we are going to see something like that happen in Greece or in Portugal. Is that what you're saying?
Sort of. You know, it's not to say that an accident in China, and the accident is inevitable, so it's not an accident. But it's not to say an accident in China is not going to have its impact on the developed market. It will. It's just a different sort of an event. A different sort of an event. Unfortunately, it's India's not an isolated case like it used to be at times, for instance, the early 90s. It was an isolated case. They went through a balance of payments problems. They had inflation problems. They brought it under control. Nobody really suffered very much around the world. Brazil has had this thing in the past, too, without too much ripple effect. Today, there's too many of these countries having this problem, and so now we have a conglomeration of all of them having them at the same time. And so that does have an impact and can have an impact on developed markets. And this is what this market decline is about. When you look at them in isolation, Turkey, it's not a big deal. Even India would have been no big deal if in isolation. But if you start taking them all together, it has an effect, a major effect on purchasing power, and global purchasing power and commodity prices, on financial markets through contagion. And so it's very hard to distinguish them anymore. I'm only saying that the analysis leading to positions in these markets is different. For Europe is different and it's different. For example, for Europe, you wouldn't want to be short really European equities. But you could be short European debt in a cheap, inexpensive way, which is the way I think we have done it, which is the way of swaps. Because there, it's just a matter of an accident. One day will happen, and then you should be able to get paid off. But in the meantime, equities are doing okay. On the other hand, equities are not doing okay in the typical traditional down cycle being experienced now by India, China, and Brazil.
Those credit default swaps that you have in Europe have been fully paid for, am I right?
Well, you can't call them fully paid for. What happens is that we have taken the brunt of the loss. In other words, the spreads have come down, and so now it's fairly cheap to carry these positions, right? And so, when we put them on last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the spreads were wider, and it cost more money to carry them. Now it costs very little money to carry them.
And what duration do we have on those?
Anywhere between the next 6 months or the next 3 years.
Uh-huh.
There's maturities coming due all the time. And what we're tending to do now is actually to renew them if we can. You know, we still have this big problem of the counterparty risk. We hope that we get paid if things happen, if the worst comes. But it's like buying insurance from an insurance company and just praying that the insurance company will survive.
The credit default swaps you have on European debt are one way that you're playing the accident. The German Bunds, I think, also satisfy the same criterion, but there are other reasons why you want to be long German Bunds.
Right, correct. I mean, the Bunds satisfy many other criteria. The fact that Europe is got almost no price inflation. So that makes it attractive to own a euro credit instrument. But then what are you going to own? You're not going to own a credit instrument of Italy or Spain because, really, it's a fool's game. So the best credit instrument you can have is the Bund. That's probably the best single instrument that you can own. So we want to be there because we think that is going to get most of the demand, investment demand, right? So that is one thing. Inflation is very favorable for the euro. Actually, I could see 10-year bonds trading at what now at 150 or something of that sort, or something of that kind, and maybe trading down to 0.50, 0.5% a year. I don't see that as a major problem. So I think that there are other factors that make a bond an attractive investment.
Your early days as an economist were shaped by monetary theory, and I'm sure that you've been looking at monetary aggregates. Do those monetary aggregates support a view of stagflation? Is that part of the reason why you're biased in the direction that you are?
Well, yeah, they don't. Let's put it this way. In countries like India and China, monetary aggregates are still growing too fast. And that's the reason why you still have balance of payments problems, for instance, in India, even in Brazil, and why you have inflation. So that's still going too fast. And in China, you have a lot of inflation via the housing market, where prices in the main cities are growing 20, 25, 30% per annum. So that's a problem in those areas. In the developed markets, Europe has had almost no growth in M3, almost no growth in M3. So that's quite, I don't know if I call it deflationary, but it's certainly not inflationary. And in the U.S., the rate of growth of money has been, of broad money, has been in the area of 6% per annum. It looked like it was going to begin accelerating 7, 7.5%, but it slowed down recently again, and we're back to 6 or under 6. That's probably not enough to get us to accelerate in either inflation or economic activity, just not enough. And we're watching it. We think that with that kind of growth, you should have more or less the same type of inflationary pressure as we have now.
What's the ratio? If money is growing at 6%, does that not mean that the price of goods should rise, or goods and services should rise by 6%?
It's more or less a reflection of nominal income. So if nominal income is split between real activity and prices, you'd say that probably real activity is in the area of 3-3.5% per annum at the moment, and prices between 2-3% per annum.
I see. Okay.
So it gets split between the two.
Okay. So speaking about home prices in China rising at 20-25% per annum, home prices now in the United States are rising in the neighborhood of 10-12% per annum. And yet you have an enormous long position in home builders, constituting 60% of the NAV of the fund, a very high beta play at that. You certainly would not be long home builders, or I don't think any kind of equity security in China. Is it because American home builders are only rising by half that, that American home prices are rising by only half the amount in China that you're long? I think it's time for an update on these home builders.
No, I think that's the point. I think in the U.S. it's really a lot more of a localized supply demand problem. You know, we haven't built houses for many years now, for 5 years or more, and so there is a genuine shortage. I won't use the word shortage, but there's a genuine scarcity of housing. And so, and in addition to that, prices had gone down 50-60%. So all we're doing now is recovering to those levels, towards those levels. And in addition to that, we still have the supply problem. So the U.S. is well positioned for continuing improvement in the home builders. In China, it's not the same case. It's not the same case. In China, a lot of the housing is being bought for investment, for speculation. We never had a decline in prices. And of course, prices are rising three times faster.
In the United States, I'm presuming that, well, a couple of things. First, if home builders, if there's a shortage and home builders are not building homes, how long? Where are the profits coming from to have engendered this wonderful rally that was part and parcel of the 17% return that we earned in January?
They are building. They are building, and you know, we had bad weather and so on, but they are building, and they're getting great prices for them too. So I think that they are building, and I think that the recent statements by the CEO of the DHI or some of the other builders and their earnings are showing that they're building, and they're doing well. They're doing very well.
Is this largely a margin play at this point?
Margin and volume, yeah.
Margin and volume.
And the volume to come, more volume to come, yeah.
Now, do you, speaking in a broadly cyclical way, is a lot of new home construction is a function of household formation and the indebtedness that those households face? So there's a demographic argument, and I guess there's also today a tuition argument. Does that play into your thinking?
I think that they say that single houses we should be building a million to a million two single houses a year given demographics.
We're at 900, right? 950?
Yeah, single houses, we're building much less than that. So I think we're still underbuilding.
Still underbuilding. So the position on home builders then is, if I understand you right, has a kind of cyclical quality, where we're really pretty early then in the cycle, because the building, the construction boom, or the construction to meet demand from a reduced supply base hasn't really begun yet, at least in earnest.
Right. We're still early in the cycle, even though normally after 5 years of economic recovery, you would have, in the past at least, you've had already housing turning down because you have monetary policy tightening, and then you have rising interest rates, and so by then already you've satisfied most of the demand. And so at this stage in previous cycles, you would see actually home building dropping or going to down cycle. It's not the case now. We've had a very weak recovery, very, very weak. Monetary policy is still very loose. We've had many years of little activity there, so supplies are a problem. So we still have probably 2 years.
Okay. Al, we've grown so used to the Fed providing liquidity that what used to be called the Great Experiment has now become kind of normal. How do you see Yellen's place in the Fed now? What do you think the ultimate effects of the provision of all this liquidity are going to be? It certainly hasn't been resolved. The tapering is at least at this point minuscule by comparison to what has been provided and to what is still being provided.
I don't know. I try not to make it my business to guess what happens at the Fed, because it's just inscrutable. You can't tell. But the one thing you could tell is that it's likely to err on the side of more ease than on the side of more tightness. It's very unlikely that you'll see a very decisive Fed trying to fight off, let's say, a pickup in inflation or a bubble in asset prices. It's very, very difficult. I mean, the Fed has already said it many times. It's very hard to identify bubbles. I know that there's some nice speeches that Jenny Yellen has spoken about, the fact that we should try to do something about it and try to identify them early enough, but they don't have enough academic intellectual arguments, or at least they don't have the tools with which to measure what is a bubble and how does it work, and when is it too much. And so and as far as inflation, I think that they would be happy with higher inflation, and I don't think that they would step in to do something about it unless it went to maybe 3% per annum, and we are way off there. And even if they did, they would do it in a very cautious manner, very slow. So I would bet that no matter who is there, no matter who is in charge of the Fed, we are going to be behind in our battle against depreciation of money and against in any form, expressed by way of consumer prices increasing or by way of asset prices rising. We're going to be behind. I think it's senseless. I think it's silly. I think it's futile to try to figure out what she thinks or what she will do from trying to learn about past speeches and past papers and things of that sort. It just doesn't happen that way.
As a monetarist, just to drift for a bit into the theoretical, as a monetarist, I think if someone had told you that liquidity was to, to this degree was going to be provided to the economy by the Federal Reserve, if someone had told you this 30 years ago and asked you to bet on whether the consequences were going to be inflation or deflation, it would be hard, I think, to have bet on what's actually transpired so far. How do you explain it?
Well, you know what? It's true, and I think that we learn things. And one of the things that we learn is the transmission mechanism. 30 or 40 years ago, we didn't have those type of financial crisis where banks became traumatized. We didn't have regulation like we're having now where you have Basel Agreement and Frank Dodd legislation scaring the wits out of the banks and forcing them to come up with higher capital ratios and things of that sort. So in that scenario, in other words, in a scenario free of all those problems, yes, the textbook would have given you the proper answer, which is an increase in reserves leads eventually to an increase in money, and it's almost dollar for dollar, and it will happen. Under present conditions, with a traumatized banking system, with an overregulated banking system, with even a problem in the demand side, where a lot of corporations today are flush with cash, and a lot of corporations, when they need money, they can go to the bond market, and money is available at good rates for them. And under those conditions, excess reserves do not translate right away into an increase in money. And if you ask me, will it happen? I my bet is still that it will happen, but it will take time. It will take time. We have to overcome all these problems. So, yes, we've learned a lot, but I think it mostly has to do with environment. Everything changes, not even environment, the context. Everything changes according to context. When Friedman and his monetarists enunciated their discoveries and talked about money, they did not foresee this type of an environment, what we have today, where banks are actually approaching the business with one hand tied behind their back and maybe both. And so we have to take that into account also.
Well, it's hard, Al, to forecast the future as we know.
Do you want to take over my position?
No, thank you. Well, although I do to some extent with my discovery fund, but I'm happy to leave you with the global macro. But thanks for the offer if it was that.
It is tough.
Let's come round to the beginning. We have just 2 minutes more if we're going to honor our obligation to let our listeners go back to work.
By the way, I just want to say one thing. I don't have it in front of me now. Give me 1 second.
Sure. Listeners, don't go. He's
I was just looking for today's Financial Times.
Sandwich, I'm sure.
I was just looking for today's Financial Times, and I just wanted to say this because it probably emphasizes a lot our point. It says there's an editorial called "The Future Still Belongs to the Emerging Markets" by Gideon Rachman, and you know basically makes the point that you know sure after all these crises that we had in the past, but they always came back, and all the emerging markets finally didn't quite catch up yet with the richer industrialized nations, but they did get closer, and their share of world GDP has grown, and what is the private consumption, investment, trade nearly doubled over the period, and so there's very little to worry about. I think this is important. This maybe deals a little bit with this question of context and hard to predict the future. It's true that the last 40, 50 years have seen these emerging countries actually grow and get very strong middle class and narrow the gap, the growth gap with the developed markets.
A billion people have been lifted out of poverty. In our lifetime, it's one of the great achievements in our brief period on Earth.
Absolutely, and the average income has grown a great deal, and today the gap is much smaller. But what we have to take into account is this. 30 or 40 years ago, these countries had very little debt. And we have abused that. All these countries have abused that. It's like people getting older, they abuse their body. And when they're 75, I'm using 75, so it's far away from me, but 75 or 80 or something like that, by the time that they get there, their bodies have been abused, and it's very hard to do the same things that you were doing when you were younger. These countries have all abused their system via corruption, via cronyism, via undisciplined government spending, via desire for all these countries to reach higher income levels. They have all gotten themselves heavily into debt, every one of them. And so the context today may be different, and Rachman may be wrong. Maybe this time is different. Maybe this time India will not be able to come out of this. We do have a live example of such a thing. We have a live example, Argentina.
Yeah, Argentina.
Argentina, and it never came back to where it was.
That's
not
right.
20 and not 30 and not 50 and not 100 years ago. It is actually today much poorer than it was 100 years ago per capita.
Right after the war, it and Australia and Canada were all on par with one another.
Exactly, in per capita income.
Yeah.
Correct. So maybe Gideon Rachman is wrong. Maybe the conventional thinking is wrong because context is very important. You know, so just as we talked about monetary policy in the proper context, we should be talking about, for example, emerging markets in the proper context. And the context is one in which every one of these countries, European countries, developed ones, and non-developed countries, they all have a lot of debt. And the debt has grown so much that servicing that debt alone becomes a burden. So we should be careful.
That's a super point, Al. Thank you. Let's just end with the portfolio per se. You had a tremendous January, and we talked about, I think it's over 15% you earned in January. And as we said at the outset, it's the mirror image of the declines that took place in mid-2013. But at the same time, you changed many things in the portfolio from a risk perspective. Now, I said at the outset that the returns in January came from all sources. So it was as though you'd bet on many different numbers on a roulette wheel that permitted that kind of thing, and they all happened to win. They all happened to come in at the same time. But I think all of us who are investors are anxious that if you can make 15 or 16% in a month, the volatility, the downside volatility can come back to haunt you and us. What have you done to safeguard, what have you learned from last year? What have you done to safeguard us from that reoccurring?
Well, we have taken a more direct approach to the volatility problem. Whereas in the past, we used to react to the volatility and not look at the portfolio, but see what happens, what actually happens. And when it does, we would react to it. Now we have, in the last 4 months, let's say, or so, we have begun to approach the problems from the leverage side first. And the first thing that we've done is we have actually cut, and it's substantially lower than it was, 40, maybe 45% lower than it was at its height, let's say in July, August. So we think that the lower leverage will probably cause lower volatility. It has. Interesting, we measure our volatility in relation to the S&P. The S&P's volatility has been extremely low in the past couple of months, until the last few days. But let's
it's actually declined since 2011 by almost half.
Right. So measure against that, we still remain somewhere a little higher than where we want to be. But if we take historical volatility of the S&P, we are where we want to be, which is we want to be between 50% and 100% higher than the S&P maximum in volatility. And I think that we can achieve that.
Okay. Al, we've got 5 minutes over our limit, but I think they were 5 minutes well spent. I thank you very much for your time, and I thank our listeners very much for their time. Please know that the conference call will be posted on the Friedberg and on the Niagara websites. And if I'm not mistaken, you'll be get notification of your. Thanks again.
Okay.
Best
Thank
of luck
you.
With your trading.
Bye-bye. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Have a good day.